Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode. Today, we are dedicating this entire episode to a Q&A. We are going to be answering questions on relationships, depression and anxiety, eating disorders, and how to support a friend with an eating disorder.
Hey guys, just a warning, this episode discusses eating disorders. If this is a trigger for you in any way, we strongly suggest that you skip this episode. Hello everybody, welcome back to another episode. I am Kat, I'm a registered psychologist.
And I'm Amy, a registered psychotherapist.
My darling Amy, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm well. Are you enjoying your holidays of isolation?
To be honest, they're not really holidays. Mm. Not as usual. I don't think anything's really usual at the moment, which is okay. But I have been doing a lot of work these holidays. I'm packing, ready to move. I've also got my partner's birthday coming up. So I've been doing a lot of organizing and planning for that. So there hasn't been too much holiday happening these holidays.
You're someone that really needs a holiday too.
I feel like even if I didn't have all these things to do, there's nothing to do anyway. So it's the perfect time to have a lot on my plate.
And you don't relax, Amy. You're probably loving that you don't have to relax. Because I remember you told me, like, I don't know when it was, maybe last holidays, you're like, how do I relax?
Yeah, I do. Although I'm much better at relaxing now, I feel. Well, there's this new Netflix series that I think I have to thank being able to sit through an episode of a show. I really struggle to watch an entire movie or to watch an entire show without getting up and doing something else.
Or falling asleep. I remember we used to sit down to watch a movie, 10 minutes in, you'd be snoring.
Yeah, it me. So have you started watching Outer Banks?
I was just going to say, is it Outer Banks? Because I absolutely love Outer Banks at the moment. It's like, for anyone who hasn't watched it, it's like the OC meets...
It's like thriller meets love story meets suspense and drama.
Would you say OC meets Riverdale?
Yeah, I'd say that's a fair assessment.
I love
Outer Banks. But something else as well, like it's like... I cried. Like
a surfy vibe.
It does. It is like OC, definitely like OC, but like thriller OC.
Yeah, like mystery. It's actually quite good. This is what I live for. I love like the teenage dramas where it's not too, like, you know, how you want something that's
it's
easy.
It's not like
to
Wallace
watch.
And Gromit where it's going to, you know, petrify you and have nightmares forever.
So for anyone listening, I am very skittish and jumpy, and I have been known to get fearful in cartoons. So this is
Wallace
actually
and Gromit, people. The animation where characters are made from clay.
Look, it was a very suspenseful moment, okay? You're never going to let me live that down. Anyway, going back, you digress, and it's so irrelevant at the moment because let's talk Outer Banks. It is a great show, but I still have to kind of turn it off every episode because I get a little bit scared. But it's a great, great show. If anyone's a little bit bored, Outer Banks is wonderful. So, my darling Amy, please tell me your pit and peak of the week.
Well, I'm going to start with my pit. I hate to start with the negative, but holy moly, I hate moving so much.
Oh, really?
I feel like it's just...
It's just literally the worst thing. Yeah. It is the worst thing. And you don't realize how much junk you have until you have to move.
And it's like it gets a little bit worse before it gets better because I feel like the further you delve into it, you realize how much more there is to do.
Yeah.
And today I went through my wardrobe and did the whole keep, throw away.
Marie Kondo'd your wardrobe?
I did. And that felt really good.
Amy has like seven doors. Amy's got the biggest wardrobe I've ever seen in my whole life. Like, you put Carrie Bradshaw to shame. It's like seven doors long.
It's a huge wardrobe. And you know what having a big wardrobe means? It means you fill it with more things. And wardrobes are hidden. They're these hidden spaces where you just put things in and you forget about them until you have to move. And it's like, oh, why have I just shoved all these clothes here? And then you go through your wardrobe and you're like, what was I thinking?
Yeah, yeah. Can you please tell our lovely listeners, if they haven't switched off already, because we have not even into the episode yet, how many pairs of tights and sports bras you own?
I can't even remember. It's grown since I've told you to, because I've recently...
Amy Hudson, you're supposed to be on a budget. That was your word of the year, frugal.
Frugal. I've been sticking to my budget, only spending my spendings. Yeah, so very proud of myself. Yeah, my tights have also grown. I don't want to say it. I don't want to encourage spending.
You want to enable our listeners.
Yeah, like it's not a thing. It's over 100. Big job though. Big job, guys.
Guys, over 100 pairs. 100 pairs.
Anyway, moving right along. My peak of the week was I had a really, really fun active day yesterday with my partner. We went to this awesome waterfall up in the Blue Mountains and it was beautiful. And we had a really silly fun day where we'd had fun dancing around. I was using TikTok and he was on Pokemon. And we were teasing each other and it was just really fun.
Oh, that sounds like a great day. Your Snapchats looked amazing.
How was your week? What's your pit?
My pit is that I don't know. I'm kind of getting a little bit sick of isolation. I really miss my family and friends. And also not sure if I'm going to have a wedding this year. And also a honeymoon. I'm very lucky that I'm alive and I'm not trying to be ungrateful, but it has definitely put a bit of a spanner in the works, brought on a little bit of anxiety and nervousness about our plans this year to get married. So that's been my pit. I've had to kind of figure out what we're going to do. And my peak would be that I have just been working and hustling. And this weekend I finally had time. I'm actually really loving having weekends off to do nothing, to finally decorate my spare room. And I made a bed all by myself and just decorated it all. And nothing feels better than nesting. I've spent a lot of money, stupid amounts of money on Adairs and any online stores, but finally have a nice new bedroom.
Well, it does look beautiful. So well done.
Thank
on
you,
the Amy. Nesting. You are quite the little designer.
No, I'm not. I look at the catalogs on Adairs or the Instagrams and I'm like, I want that. I'll just buy all the things in this picture and make it magically, hopefully look like that. So it's more just mimicking, really, rather than actually designing anything. But it's wonderful. I like actually making your house look nice. It's nice to come home to something that's, home, not that I go out, but nice to stay home with a nice room.
Yeah, I think that's important too. And you've done a great job at it. It looks beautiful.
So we might jump straight into our episode.
So we might start off with one of a longer, I guess a little bit more detailed question that we had from a lovely follower who wrote in asking how she could support a friend with an eating disorder. She was actually really comprehensive, and I love when we get in longer questions that kind of give us a little bit of a story and a little bit of insight. And I think that's helpful for the person asking the question as well, because it allows us to go a little bit more deeper in answering the question.
Yeah.
So this person is asking how to support their friend with an eating disorder. She's an athlete. She has a lot of professionals around her to support her, like a physiotherapist and a dietitian, as well as a personal trainer. And she is basically saying that she's struggling how to best support her through this time, because she does have all the support of professionals around her, and she feels like on one hand she's not listening to her and her advice falls on deaf ears, and she almost feels like she's resenting her friend for burdening her when she has all these qualified health professionals there to help her. So she feels like she's in this really tricky situation where she's trying to help her friend, but she feels like her friend's not listening and she has a wealth of knowledge around her to help her. So I'm sensing that this person is feeling quite frustrated and like she says, resenting her friend a little bit. Yeah, very drained.
I mean, I think eating disorders are extremely draining for the person and the people around them, particularly if that person isn't doing what you want them to do. I think from the outside, it's so simple to look and say, just eat food or just do this or just follow that advice. It's so easy to look and think it's right in front of you. All you got to do is follow that advice, eat some food, don't train so much. But it's very, very different for the actual person going through it. It's certainly not that straightforward and simple, but I can totally appreciate and understand that it's quite exhausting and quite draining on a friend if you're trying to look after someone who does have an eating disorder.
Yeah, definitely. And it's very difficult to watch someone you care about go through that and to display a lot of the concerning behaviors and symptoms associated with eating disorders. Yeah. I think for someone that has never suffered from an eating disorder, like this listener says, can really struggle to understand, not only understand the behavior, but understand how to help them. It is a really helpless situation to be in.
Yeah. And I think it's really good to point out here that you as a friend, your role is not to fix them. You're not their therapist. And your role is not to cure them or to make them see the light, or, you know, there's nothing that really, you know, you're supposed to be doing except to support them. And it sounds like you're actually taking on quite a fair bit of the responsibility for your friend, which is very lovely. But you do have to realize that there comes a time when, even though she's getting support from health professionals, it sounds like maybe the health professionals are either not recognizing it or she's not listening to the health professionals. So if she's not even listening to health professionals, she might not even be listening to you, meaning that there's not much that you can say that could help fix her. I think that the only thing you can do is continue to be her friend, and by friend, you know, talk to her, talk about things that aren't related to her eating disorder or food. Just check in with her, let her know that you're there if you need her, that you're worried, but it's not your job to try and fix her.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I think that'd be my main point as well, is your job as her friend is to be her friend. Talk to her about everyday things that you would any other friend. Mm. I think if you are struggling with how best to support someone with an eating disorder, the number one thing, if you're trying to help someone with an eating disorder, would be to encourage them to seek treatment, and as soon as possible, sooner rather than later, because eating disorders lead to a host of health consequences, both physical and psychological. And the longer it goes on, additional complications as a result of the eating disorder can occur. So again, like Kat said, that's not your responsibility, and someone's eating disorder isn't on you. But if you're looking at ways that you can help support a friend, approaching them in a really caring and sympathetic nature can be really helpful, because sometimes with eating disorders, they're not thinking logically and rational. Like, the reasoning kind of goes out the window, because not only, I guess, in a functional way, like attention, concentration, focus, those kinds of things, but eating disorders kind of take over your whole being, your whole thinking. So sometimes people can kind of lose sight on how their eating disorder is impacting their daily life. And I think also educating yourself about the disorder and treatment options can be really helpful as well. So this might seem kind of silly or obvious to point out, but before you try and help someone, understanding different symptoms and different concerns is really important, because you'll gain insight as to how that's affecting your friend, and that will give you a little bit more, I guess, a deeper level of understanding as to what they might be going through and how you can support them in a non-judgmental, non-critical way. Because, like, I think when I think about it from a really general perspective, a lot of people kind of have that misconception that someone with an eating disorder is a young, skinny girl that chooses to have that eating disorder because they want to be skinny, you know?
Yeah, and that's certainly not always the case. Whether it does stem from that negative body image, or it might stem from something completely different. But as I said, this is not your role to try and, like, as a friend to, you know, figure out those thoughts and where it's come from. I mean, you can try and ask, but I think people with eating disorders, they are quite defensive. And I think to look at it this way, someone with an eating disorder, that's the control that they have in their life. And by you offering to help them means that they have to change how they eat or what they eat, or if they do eat at all. And that is very threatening to them. So they will reject help as much as they can, because what that means is that they remain in control and they remain, you know, having those negative eating habits or those really distorted thinking, because that for them is, I guess, keeping them sane or keeping them in control. So it's quite common that people with eating disorders will reject help a lot of the time and become quite defensive because they're scared. There's fear there that if you, you know, are trying to help them, that you'll hospitalize them and make them gain weight, or you'll hospitalize them and, I don't know, change whatever they're doing at the moment. So there's lots of fear with people with eating disorders, and it's quite
and even denial. Like it's quite common for them to deny that there's anything wrong.
Absolutely. So I think be really realistic with the way that you approach your friend, because you can just go in with the expectation that they will reject your help. And that doesn't mean that you're a bad friend or that you've done the wrong thing. What that means is that they are scared to get help, and you offering to help can come to them as a bit of a threat. So ensuring that you don't take that personally, and just let them know that regardless of what they choose, if they do want help or if they don't, that you're still there. It doesn't come with an ultimatum. If you, you know, you have to get help if you want to stay my friend, that's not helpful at all. I'd also suggest really looking after yourself in this time. Yes, it's really good to keep supporting your friend and being really non-judgmental, as Ames was saying, but really stepping back and setting some boundaries for yourself, because it is extremely draining to be looking after someone with an eating disorder. So make sure you have a support network for yourself, and yeah, make sure you talk to someone else about it. And you can also talk to a therapist or just talk to your other friends as well. So just making sure you do have a trusted support network that you can kind of debrief and unload to would be helpful.
Yeah, 100%. I think that's the most important thing when supporting someone with an eating disorder, is just to make sure you're taking care of yourself first, because you can't fill from an empty cup. And if you're constantly putting someone else before you, you'll burn out and you won't be able to, you know, keep that support sustainably. So just making sure that you're looking after yourself. And this is heavy stuff. So like Kat said, making sure that you've got some support around you, or that you're talking to someone to work through this, because yeah, it is. It is really tricky.
Also, be mindful as well of your own mental health and your own triggers with eating disorders, because having a friend talk about their own eating disorders can really trigger your own. So, you know, you might say, oh my God, if my friend thinks they're fat, that must mean, imagine what they think about me. Or so just be really mindful of that as well. And that's something you can talk to your support network about.
The most you can do for someone is just listening to them and just being there when they need you. That is going to do so, so much more than what you probably give yourself credit for. Like Kat said, your job is not to fix someone or to cure them of their eating disorder. You just being there as a support for them is going to be their strength. It's going to make the world of difference.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said.
Okay, so question is, how to know if you are ready for a relationship?
Amy, this might be one for you.
Okay, so I don't think we can ever really come to a stage in our life where we're like, yep, I'm 100% sure this is the time where I am ready for a relationship. And if you do, then I think that's a real rarity. But I think the first and foremost thing is to kind of think about how you feel about yourself. That's the most important relationship in your life, is the one you have with yourself. How are you feeling psychologically, physically? If you are feeling happy and worthy and you're ready to share yourself with someone else as an addition to what you already have, then I think that's a really good indicator that you're in a good spot for a relationship. I think an indicator that you might not be is if you're thinking that you need a relationship to fill something that might be missing, or if, you know, you're comparing yourself to different friends or family members at the stage they're in their life, and you're thinking, well, I'm at the right age for a relationship, therefore I need one. But, you know, everyone is different. Everyone is at a different stage in their life, you know, irrespective of your age. So I think the best indicator is, how are you feeling with yourself? How is your relationship with yourself looking? And whether a relationship would just be a really nice addition. Yeah, offer you just, you know, some extra love and that kind of thing, then I think that's when you know that you're ready for a relationship.
Yeah, well said, Ames. Yeah, I mean, the only thing I can really add on top of that is, you know, are you doing it for the right reasons? Are you doing it because you generally just want to share your life with someone? You're ready to open up your heart to someone, go into it expecting that there is risk, obviously, with every relationship of getting your heart broken or, you know, getting hurt. But that is really, you know, you can't avoid that. Or is it for the wrong reasons? Another one I might add, Ames, is if you've just gotten out of a relationship and you feel like you need someone else just to fill that spot, just to fill that void, or if your ex has moved on quicker than what you have, you feel like you need to move on quickly. So just remember that you've got to go at your own pace as well. And, you know, no one's ever 100% ready for a relationship, so just keep that in mind. But there's nothing wrong with taking it really slow with someone if you are a little bit on the fence.
Definitely. Okay, so question number two for relationships was, how do you know if the guy you're dating is too good for you or not?
Wow. I guess just exploring why you think that they're too good for you. What is it about them that makes you, it sounds like you may be getting a bit self-conscious around them. What is it that you think is too good about them, or something that thinks that you're not good enough? Because there seems to be a bit of disparity between what you think is good enough for them. So really exploring that, that's a really interesting question. But it sounds like you maybe need to, you're lacking in a bit of self-confidence and self-esteem. This actually might be a good question to talk to your friends about, because your friends know your strengths really well. And it sounds like you maybe need reminding of your beautiful qualities and strengths that you have, because it is easy to forget your own strengths.
Yeah, I love that. Definitely talk to your friends to give you a pep talk, because I agree. I think this is a really interesting question that a lot of people struggle with. And I think what's annoying when you find someone that's really amazing and you're like, oh my gosh, like I found this amazing person, you get really excited, but then you kind of have that worry that, oh, maybe they're too good. I think questioning whether someone's too good for you isn't so good, because it can stop a relationship from forming out of fear that you're not good enough. I think we are all unique individuals, and you know that I don't think there's such thing as someone being too good for you. I think a connection is a connection. And you know, when you see someone walking down the street and you think, or like, you know, someone might say, oh my gosh, how did that guy get that girl? Or
he's punching.
Yeah, they're punching, right? Well, or we might think they're mismatched, but connection will always trump what's right on paper or surface level physical attraction. I think that's what you have to really focus on. Do you walk away from that person feeling bad about yourself, or do you think, wow, they're such an amazing person and I'm really lucky to have found them? I think that's what's important in this situation, is what's making you feel like they're too good for you or you're not good enough. Is it that, you know, they're super amazing and you just can't believe how lucky you are to have found them, or, and you have a really good connection with them and it's like too good to be true? Or is it that when you walk away from them, you feel less worthy or less valuable? I think that's what I'd be looking into.
Yeah. Is it something that they're doing that's making you feel not good enough? I mean, are they constantly reminding you how good they are? Is this coming from them, or is it coming from your own self-esteem issues and maybe self-confidence within the relationship? I guess it's really good to nut that out, where it's coming from, because sometimes people can be, I mean, just really coming off the back of our manipulator episode, sometimes people can be really sneaky with the way that they put other people down. It might come across as a compliment, but really deep down it's an insult. So just be really wary of where that is coming from. And have you felt that before with previous relationships? Is this a common pattern for you? Good to also remember that if it's beginning of the relationship, I'm not sure if it said that in the question, but in the beginning of the relationship, everyone puts on their like best self and their best front and the most perfect version of themselves. So there's a good chance that if you're just initially starting out dating this person or seeing them, that they probably haven't shown you their flaws, just because they might be nervous or they want to put their best self first. So just cautious that this person probably does have flaws. They might just not have shown it to you yet.
Yeah, definitely. And just to remember that no one's perfect. Like we're all unique humans. We all have our strengths and shortcomings, and they might be thinking the exact same thing about you. They might be thinking, yeah, wow, you're so amazing, not sure if you're too good for me. I think, like Kat said, in during the initial stages of a relationship, it's normal to kind of have those feelings where you're like, wow, like they're so perfect because we do put our best foot forward.
yeah, absolutely. It's a really good quote, Ames. Do you remember it? And it's like,
we accept the love we think we deserve.
Exactly. So just remember that if you think that you're not good enough, then there's a good chance this relationship won't last. But if you keep thinking that you are good enough and that you do deserve this person because you deserve the absolute world, there's a good chance that this relationship will last. So just remember to really back yourself on this. No one's better than anyone.
Yeah. Love that. Okay. I love this question. Does long distance actually work, and how common is cheating in this circumstance?
Oh, Amy, this is a good question for you. You have done long distance, so tell us about that.
I think long distance can work. Mm-hmm. I don't think that just because you're doing long distance, it's doomed forever. I think it depends on a number of factors. Long distance works when you are both on the same page. So if one person is perhaps uncomfortable with long distance, then I think that's a factor that may contribute to the downfall of that relationship. I think if there's an end date to going long distance, I guess it allows you to know that it's not a forever situation, and that can be beneficial, I feel.
It allows you to plan as well. You can kind of plan a bit of the future and just kind of have a bit of comfort knowing that there is an end date and you're not having to be in limbo all the time. You can kind of survive.
I think comfort's the thing. Comfort's what I'm looking for. If you have an end date, you feel comfortable knowing that this situation isn't forever and, you know, it's just a phase of the relationship that you're both willing to do to keep it going, to make it work. I think that's the key. And communication, 100% communication is
Number one, so
important for long distance. Yeah. And making sure you still feel like your needs are being met in different ways and compromise. And then the next part of how common is cheating? Well,
how long's a piece of string? it depends on the person, doesn't it?
And cheating is something that can happen in any relationship, whether you're long distance or not. I think that there's this idea of long distance relationships being more prone to cheating, but I think it's not nearly as common as you would think. I think the same rules apply to any relationship with cheating, is that if there are, risk factors, that there's maybe a history or certain needs aren't being met, or, you know, a host of different things, then yeah, it's just as common as any other relationships.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. And it sounds like there is a bit of anxiety with the cheating side of things. So maybe this person has been cheated on before and they're very cautious about, starting a relationship with someone who's long distance. But just, I think we said this last question, but with every relationship becomes a bit of a risk, but I guess you won't know unless you try, and you don't want to say no to the relationship and then always think back. What ifs are the worst thing. So at least give it a try and have that communication. Also schedule times where you're going to see them. Have like a weekly or every, 2 days or every day time that you see them, because that really, even if it's the unknown, even if there is no end date, that provides a little bit of structure and comfort as well.
I think what I'm hearing this question is that fear of being out of sight, out of mind, which is really, really common with long distance relationships. It's that, well, if I'm not there, of course you're going to get tempted by someone else. So I think what you're saying is right. If you have something planned, like a FaceTime date every couple of days, or even if it's just a phone call, just to have that consistent communication. And like I said, to ensure that your needs are still being met and that you still feel attended to and cared for, and you're still in your partner's thoughts. I think that's really important.
Yeah, I agree. I think long distance and cheating often is quite stereotypical, but it's not always the case. There's lots of people who have had successful long distance relationships. It really just is up to the couple. And remember, it takes two to tango. It takes equal effort on both parts in order for this to work. So one person should not be carrying the load with this. And fighting, it's really a lot easier to, I guess, get a bit of distance within the relationship if you're fighting over text or even phone calls. You're not forced to work it out
on the spot like you would be in person. So maybe set up some ground rules for fighting. And it might sound really, silly, but having some rules, like if you don't hear from me in 2 hours, please call me, even though I won't want you to, because you know how when you're fighting, you just want to go away and you kind of sometimes want them to chase you. So really setting up some ground rules for arguments and making sure that you follow through with them.
I think that is such a great tip. No arguments over text, because yeah, everything gets skewed, and it's better to have the conversation over the phone.
It's dragged out so much longer when it's over the phone, isn't it? I mean, when it's in person, it's just kind of a big explosion, but then it's kind of worked through. You're kind of forced to deal with it.
And you can't hear the other person. You hear it from your perspective because you're reading it with your emotions and how you feel, whereas it's just different coming from the other person. You're able to hear them better.
Really good tip that I have with fighting that works obviously not just for long distance, but something I find so, so helpful with clients is when you're fighting, don't say you did this and you did that. What you really need to say is, you know, you need to become a bit vulnerable. You need to say, I felt scared when you did that. And also making it sound like, were you angry or were you fearful? I mean, I feel like with every fight, there's a bit of vulnerability underneath it. There's fear, there's insecurity, there's this inner child that's trying to come out and get angry. There's anxiety. So really drilling down and saying, I felt anxious when you said you're going out with the boys. So instead of saying, I felt angry, because that's quite a defensive statement. I mean, still really helpful, but drilling down to what was actually underneath that anger. I felt anxious. I felt insecure. I felt worried. Those are really good statements because it actually kind of decreases the defensiveness of it and almost a confrontation. It actually shows the other person that, hey, I really care about you and this is why I'm getting frustrated, rather than you did something wrong. So I found that to be quite helpful, is to kind of highlight your vulnerabilities, even though it's hard in an argument because you want to put up your armor, but really taking off that armor and putting in, making your vulnerabilities heard loud and clear. That's a really good way to defuse a fight as well.
Definitely. I statements are a great way to resolve conflict. Okay, how to cope with feeling like you're going to be single forever?
I think it sounds like there's a bit of exhaustion in this question. There's a bit of tried and tested and feel like I'm never going to meet anybody. That's the vibe I get from this seven-word question. I think it's a really, really tricky place to be when, and it's quite an exhausting place if you are someone who's tried and dated a lot and you just haven't found someone right for you, because I guess it leaves you with a few questions of, oh, maybe I should just lower my expectations. Maybe that person was actually really good for me. Maybe I should just, you know, go for this person I kind of like but don't really click with and see where it goes. I feel like it actually like leaves you questioning your own judgment a little bit as well, and yourself. It leaves you thinking like, oh, am I not attractive? Am I not good enough for someone? I think like being single really makes you quite insecure and self-conscious of yourself, because I think there's that assumption that something's wrong with you. And I think that that can be quite a, I guess, a spiral that you can get stuck in, especially if you don't have anyone to talk about it to, because sometimes we get so lost in that insecurity and it become quite debilitating to worry about being single. I think if you're single, it's less about you and maybe more about that you haven't met the right person. I know that sounds really cliche, but I think being single doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you.
I agree. I think especially in comparison to others is always a big contributing factor to when you feel like you're never going to find someone or you're going to be single forever, is usually when a lot of people in your social circle are in relationships or, you know, have reached a point in their lives where they have married and settled down, or, you know, they're hitting milestones like getting engaged or buying houses together. I think it kind of, it's that point where you feel like you're so far behind in the process that it's just never going to happen to you. Or if, like you said, Kat, you've been through a couple of different relationships and you feel like, well, everything's failed, so nothing's going to work. And I think you know, you you can become really critical of yourself. You know, it might be that you think you're not attractive, so no one's ever going to be attracted to you, or that your personality's flawed. I think it's really important to trust the process and invest in yourself. When you know, are learning every day and doing things that make you really happy. Like I said in the first question, when you are feeling really content in yourself, and, you know, a relationship would just be an additional bonus, or, you know, just a little cherry on top of you living your life, I think is how you overcome that feeling of feeling like you're going to be single forever. I think what's important is to cut yourself some slack. You don't have to find a relationship at the time where society tells you to find a relationship. I feel like there's so much pressure on people to, you know, get married, have kids, all that kind of stuff, so that when you're not married or you haven't found someone by an age that you expected to, it does have that real, you know, negative feeling like, oh my gosh, like quick, it's a race against, you know, where I'm told myself I was going to be and now I'm not there. So what if it never happens? I feel like cut yourself some slack, give yourself some grace and trust in yourself and trust that you are going to meet someone that's so deserving of you when you've done all the things that you need to do to get there.
I think that's really sage advice, my darling Amy. And also, there are lots of people who are single their whole life and it's fine. I mean, I think where you got to step outside and remember that you don't have to be in a relationship. I know that people kind of feel like you have to because all my friends are, or I want kids, or I want this milestone to happen. I want to get married. But you don't. Also, there is no rush. And I think if you rush into something, or if you just want someone just because you feel like you should, you're probably doing it for the wrong reasons and that relationship might not last. So there's nothing wrong with being single at all. There are probably heaps of people in relationships who are quite lonely or are unhappy and wish they were single. I know it's really, I remember when I was single and everyone would be like, you'll meet someone. And I'm like, shut up, because that's not helpful. It's not what I want to hear. But I think one of the best advice I got was that, you know, you do your own thing, and if someone comes along, great, but if not, that you will survive and be okay if they don't. I think just adjusting your expectations and remembering that you're independent and this is your time, because when you're in a relationship, you kind of forget, like when you're single, you think relationships are wonderful and roses and butterflies, and but you forget that in a relationship, you actually have got another person to support. You don't have a lot of time for your own hobbies. You don't have a lot of time for your friends. You really, it can be quite exhausting being in a relationship. So use this time as a time to really find yourself and do those things you've always wanted to do, and trust that if you do want to meet someone, that you will later on.
Definitely. I love that. I feel like we're just cheerleaders then.
I know, honestly.
Go, girl. Okay, I love this question, because if it's not TMI, I can relate to this so much. Non-existent sex drive during the pandemic.
Oh, I think everybody can relate to that.
Yeah, it's a real thing.
What is going on?
I think it's just stress. Like, we know that cortisol lowers our libido. And during this time of uncertainty and, you know, like really big like daily life disruptions, I think everyone is a little bit more stressed and on edge, and that kind of does inhibit your libido or your sex drive.
Absolutely. I mean, I think idealistically we look at the pandemic and think, oh wow, you know, heaps of time at home, I'm going to learn a new skill, I'm going to take up cooking, I'm going to learn Spanish, I'm going to have sex every single day. No, that is actually not how it is, because it's very, as Amy was saying, we're in a stress response at the moment. We're in uncharted territory we've never had to deal with before. Our last thing that's probably going on in our brain is thinking about reproduction right now. What it's thinking about is surviving. People have lost their jobs. We're unsure whether, you know, we can't plan anything. It's very uncertain. So of course your libido is low. I think that's very normal and a very appropriate response to a worldwide pandemic. It's not a fun holiday where we're all chill and stress-free and we're all getting off work. It's actually the opposite of that. So really just normalizing that for you, and please know that I think everyone's feeling that.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it also helps to understand and take the responsibility off yourself, that there's nothing wrong with you. And I guess that it's just a normal thing when we are in a very stressful situation that our nervous system responds and our libido decreases, that it's, there's nothing wrong with your relationship or there's nothing wrong with you. It's just a natural and biological mechanism that happens when we're stressed.
And it's as simple as that. It's just literally your body responding to what's happening in the outside world. So if you do have a partner that's badgering you a little bit about it or is annoying you, maybe just having a conversation with them and saying, look, I'm just feeling a bit stressed at the moment and I'm not really feeling it. Can we maybe talk about it and maybe figure out ways we can both meet both of our needs? Sometimes people might also not be feeling a stress response. So they might be thinking, sweet, like all this time at home, my sex drive has increased, but some people are not feeling that at all. So just good to have that communication if you do have a partner.
Definitely. And I think if this is something that you are struggling with, one or a couple of things that you can do is decide how you're going to handle this as a team. Like communicate, hey, like I'm feeling like I've really lost my sex drive or just not feeling it as much because I'm feeling really stressed. Well, you might be able to discuss, well, maybe one way we can work on fighting this stress together is maybe we'll give each other a massage, and it doesn't have to lead to sex. It's just a really nice way that we can look after each other and calm ourselves down by giving each other a really nice relaxing massage, or maybe doing a yoga flow together or some mindfulness meditation. But it's something that you can do together to promote intimacy. Also just acknowledging that your sex drive will fluctuate and that's normal. So once you kind of both have the understanding that, hey, it's normal that when life happens, I might not feel like it as much. And I think just to have that acknowledgement from your partner and to be able to say like, hey, yeah, my nervous system's kicking in. This is natural. This is part of a biological response. And, just to be able to have that acknowledgement from your partner might take some of that pressure off from feeling like, I'm sorry, it's not happening for me. That can be helpful. And then just to focus on other things that don't involve sex. Like Kat was saying, sometimes you might just need a cuddle or a kiss, or, just to lie next to each other in the lounge when you're watching Netflix or something like that. And just to have intimacy in other ways that aren't sex.
Yeah. And just remember, during a pandemic, it's not your job to fulfill your partner's sexual desires all the time. Need to cut yourself a bit of slack.
Okay, so now we'll pop into our anxiety and depression questions. Kat, can anxiety actually be cured once we have it? Does it ever go away or do we have it forever?
Okay, think about anxiety as a biological response. So think of it like breathing, think of it like blinking, think of it like your heart beating. So no, unfortunately, anxiety never goes away, but it is there to keep you safe. So if you're new to anxiety, you don't know much about it, what's happening in your body is your nervous system is responding to a threat in your environment. And that's where you get the increased heart rates, where you get the sweatiness, it's where you get the really dull feeling or the worrying feeling that something bad's going to happen. So unfortunately, we will always have anxiety. Everybody has a little bit of anxiety, just on different severity levels. Remember, it is designed, it's there to keep you safe and to survive. So it doesn't mean though that it always has to take over your life. So what it means is that you have strategies to manage it. You know when your brain's being too overprotective and you know when to kind of switch off those anxious thoughts. You know when to say, actually, I know I'm getting worried here for no reason and I'm actually okay. I know I need to do my deep breaths, or I know I need to listen to music, or I know I need to call my mum. So yes, it's always going to be there. Unfortunately, everyone does have it, but please take solace in the fact that it's, if anything ever bad happened to you, your anxiety kicks in and it can probably save your life, and know that it doesn't have to overtake your life. You just got to work out what your triggers and strategies are as well. So, yeah, unfortunately, I can't cure, people aren't cured of anxiety. It doesn't ever fully go away, but it can certainly be managed, and you can get to the point of managing your anxiety where it becomes automatic, it becomes unconscious, where you can switch it off.
Beautifully said. Couldn't have put it better myself. One thing that I tell my clients, they are children, but it can work for adults too, is that you don't have to be cured from anxiety. You can friend your worries for keeping you safe. Your body is just doing a really, really good job at keeping you safe. But yeah,
love that, Amy.
Providing that, they're not at
Do not friend your trauma.
Yeah, do not friend. Anyway, moving right along to the next question. Could my depression stem from my unconscious trauma?
Amy, this is up your alley.
This lovely listener with the most insightful questions. Extremely so she insightful. Actually provided a little bit of context around this and said that she wasn't actually aware that she had experienced trauma. However, she kind of knew that she was depressed or had symptoms of depression and then realized that what she had experienced was trauma. And could that depression have stemmed from a subconscious trauma? And the really, really short, simplistic answer to that is yes, because some stressful or traumatic experiences, such as, say, childhood abuse, live in our memories. So it's kind of think of it like a little shadow that you maybe aren't aware of, like this listener wasn't aware of, but it's like a little shadow in our brain that impacts us, or it creates an emotional response. But for many different reasons, we might not remember exactly what that was. But yes, so feelings can live in our memories and they are accessible to our subconscious and normal consciousness as well. So memories that are formed in a particular mood or state can be retrieved when different things may activate that memory or trigger that memory. Or like this listener is saying, just an unconscious feeling that she might have been reliving.
Yeah. Behaviors and emotions can manifest from lots of different things. Certainly they can manifest from trauma, even if you didn't realize it at the time, or if you feel like, oh, no, it wasn't that big a deal, or, you know, I felt like I resolved that, or I felt like I moved past that. It can certainly still linger and manifest in other ways if it's not really resolved properly. In the question, she said that it was quite long ago, her trauma, right?
I think it was 14 years ago.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, if you are, if that was in childhood, then certainly, I mean, in childhood, we don't have the cognitive functioning to deal with trauma. So of course we can certainly manifest in so many other ways. Eric cannot manifest at all until a little bit later. It can surface 10, 15, 20, sometimes 20 years later. So certainly I agree with Ames. It can certainly manifest with depression. It's really just good to talk it out with someone. Make sure you do have a therapist who is trauma informed, like Amy, who can talk you through what happened, and just be prepared for, I guess, a pretty, if it's manifested this long after, it obviously sounds like it's not resolved. So it can be quite, Ames, and you'll know this, quite draining talking about trauma. So just make sure you've got that support network around you as well.
Also, sorry, it says she wasn't aware of her trauma until 14. So that sounds about right. Oh, she was at a stage of development where she could conceptualize what she'd experienced and draw associations to an emotional response. So,
but even at 14, you might not still have that maturity to understand why this trauma occurred. So you might, maybe even at 14, you might have still had some manifestations of other behaviors that you weren't aware of, or maybe you just couldn't understand why this would have happened. So even at 14, that's actually still quite young to understand trauma. So perhaps it wasn't dealt with, or maybe you just didn't have someone to talk it through, or maybe just didn't realize, I guess, you know, when you're that young, Ames, and you just don't realize something's a big deal until you look back later on in life and you think, oh my God.
You literally just adapt.
You do. You do.
Yeah. You can't actually process what's happening. You just adapt and develop different ways of coping with the situation. And that's what we see a lot with trauma, is that children will develop different behavioral ways of coping with situations. And like this listener is saying, it had an emotional response in symptomology that's linked to depression. So yes, like I said, I like to explain it as like a little shadow. Maybe you can't really understand why it's there or what caused it to be there, but you know the feeling. So you might not remember exactly what happened, but you can kind of link feelings to different stages of your childhood, maybe. And you can say, well, I kind of started feeling like this when this happened, or when I was this old. And then that's usually when we'll explore, okay, well, what was happening around then? And maybe that's when different memories will pop up and we can kind of go into causes and things like that then.
Yeah. And also just with depression, it is quite a overriding feeling of helplessness and feeling powerless. So please, please make sure that you are talking to someone about this, preferably a therapist, because if it kind of goes under the radar a little bit, or you think it's not such a big deal, just be really wary, because I guess prolonged periods of helplessness and powerlessness can kind of get you into a bit of a spiral or a bit of a dark place. So please reach out for help if you need it.
That's a really good point. Depression can often be one of those silent things that we don't feel okay, but we're not sure. So yeah, definitely making sure we reach out and get help. So the next question is, how would you advise supporting a family member who suffers from several mental health issues, and specifically in the workplace? This family member has had a few times they have called in sick due to having a bad day, and now is being perceived as unreliable in the workplace. And this person also works at the same place, and it's frustrating not only being a sibling to this person and having the knowledge of mental health, being a fourth year psych student, but also I think frustration with how much people don't understand and accept mental health issues, I think is what she's saying.
So she's frustrated. There's a few parts to this because her family,
big question.
Her family member, her brother, her sibling is not showing up to work, and they do have mental health issues that she's quite concerned about. But on the other hand, she's actually feeling maybe a little bit of frustration at the workplace, because it sounds like they're not handling this person's mental health very well. They're not maybe believing it, or maybe they're just dismissing it or downplaying it.
Definitely. So how would we suggest helping in a workplace setting, how would we suggest helping someone suffering from mental health issues?
I think obviously it's a bit complex because you do work in the same place, but I think that also gives you an advantage, because what that means is that you know people in that workplace. I'm not sure what kind of workplace it is, but usually there is someone, I don't know if it's HR or maybe just a boss that you can sit down and talk to. I mean, obviously you do, you know, you're studying psych, so you are aware of this, but also just be really wary that they might not take it seriously. But you certainly can express your concerns and your knowledge of what you know about mental health to your boss. Also, it is discrimination to treat someone unfairly due to their mental health concerns. So I'm hearing that maybe you feel a little bit, you're kind of taking, you're feeling like this is your responsibility because they are your family member. And while I can certainly hear that you do love this sibling a lot, just good to take off that responsibility that they're going through something, and it's not your job to try and control what other people think of them. It is your job as a sibling to just be there for them. I think it's quite easy trap to fall into when you're studying psych to want to help everyone who you can see with a mental health issue, but just please take a step back and remember you are their sibling, and make sure that you don't try and diagnose them or try and fix them. So making sure that you are supporting them as best as you can, but also making your workplace aware of what's going on. And if they're not listening, trying to take it up the chain a little bit and talking to someone who will listen. But if that's kind of a dead end, you certainly can suggest some resources as well. It's a bit tricky in a workplace because you can't force your boss or a supervisor or your HR manager to understand mental health, especially when you're protective and you just want the best for your sibling. But you certainly can let them know what you know about your family member and you're concerned about them. And I guess also just putting it in a way, like, I'm just trying to get into the business perspective. They love productivity and they love to know if someone is working really hard. That's kind of their motivation. That's what they want from their employees. So putting it in a way that's like, if, you know, I really need this person to get help, they need to take some of their sick days, because if they get help quicker, they're more likely they are to come back to work and be able to continue working. So maybe putting in more of like a businessy perspective could really help your employer to understand more.
Yeah, definitely. Pretty much covered that one. I definitely agree with, if you feel comfortable to taking it up with your boss, or as Kat said, even further up the ladder, because it is really important that, I guess, managers are aware and are supportive of their employees, and that there is a certain duty of care in making sure that if there is something, you know, going on or affecting someone's ability to work, that your sibling feel comfortable to have that conversation. Not always, you know, you might not always feel comfortable to, but if they do, I think it might be important coming from the person who's experiencing the mental health issues that might be debilitating and might be stopping them to come from work, and maybe discussing different strategies with their managers and with your employer, just to make sure you're all on the same page and you're working together, and that way they can be a little bit more understanding of how they work best and what might be factors that conflict with different symptoms. And I also really agree with what Kat said, that making sure that managers maybe have different resources, and it's really great that you are, you know, I guess, aware of mental health and you can advocate for mental health and maybe suggest different resources and training, things like that, that your colleagues and managers can do, so that you can kind of provide opportunities to get a little bit more relevant information and training to advocate for mental health problems and well-being for staff. I think this situation might be a really good opportunity to look at systematic differences in the way that people act and think and feel, and different things that managers can do to understand every employee is different, and there might be some things that they can do better to support their employees.
Yeah, and I think just rereading the question, he's caught this person, this family member has called in sick a few times. That's actually not, there's nothing wrong with calling in sick. It's frustrating for the employer, but we are legally entitled to sick days. And whether that falls under mental health days or regular sick days, that's completely okay. I guess when you say he has severe mental health concerns, it'd be really, really helpful that you do try and link him up with a support as well, because they can certainly support your sibling at work as well, whether it's a psychologist or a therapist, so he has someone to talk to. It's a really tricky one, because it's not just you're their sibling and you're really worried about them, but you're also their colleague at work, and you're battling, you know, a whole company to try and make them understand mental health if they don't already have that. It sounds like they don't have much understanding. So it's two big battles here that you are trying to conquer, but just supporting your sibling is the most important thing. And then making sure that if your company has that awareness, and there's certain trainings they can ask for, types of different mental health trainings that employees can ask to come in and I guess kind of train the trainers, train the bosses and the supervisors about mental health. It might sound really, I don't know, airy-fairy, and I know we've certainly got that stigma in the workforce, but mental health is extremely important, and it is something that is unfortunately on the uprise. So if it's a workplace that has also, I'm not sure, some, I don't know what the workplace is. It could be a tiny little cafe, or it could be like a really multi-million dollar industry, but the bigger industries do mostly have employee assistance programs, so counseling, things like that. So if you do work in an industry like that, maybe look out for that, whether, see whether that's offered as well for your sibling and yourself as well. It sounds like you're doing a lot for your sibling, so make sure you've got the your support network around you and your friends to talk to, because it sounds like you're, you know, fourth year psych is hard enough, let alone having to worry about a sibling who's got some severe mental health issues. So make sure you take care of yourself. Alrighty, I think that's all the time we have for today for Q&A. I hope that has answered some of our lovely listeners' questions. Thank you everyone for writing in. We might make this more of like a common episode, Ames.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. We love getting questions from you guys.
We do. And just a reminder, guys, this isn't personalized advice. We don't know your story, so we can't offer personalized advice. This is just for general informational purposes only. But we hope that we've given you guys a bit of guidance and further information. And we always say this, but please reach out to your support network as well if you do need it. Thank you guys so much for listening, and we will catch you next episode.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks so much for tuning in to today's episode. If you want to see more, please follow us on Instagram at The Psychology Sisters. To make sure that you never miss another episode, please hit the subscribe button in the podcast app. If you know someone who might enjoy this episode, we would love you to share this with them. Please note, the content shared in this episode is purely educational and does not replace personalized advice from a mental health professional. See you next week for more spicy science and sexy self-help.